From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is nothing like the smell of a roast in the oven or a pie cooling on the counter. You can get your fix by watching cooking shows on TV, or you can just get cooking. Millions of home cooks tune in to the New York Times Cooking newsletter for inspiration and instruction. Recipes for perfect pancakes and roasted garlicky chicken thighs, just to name a few. Yes, you can turn out a beautiful vegetable tart, a creamy chocolate pudding, even a cassoulet. We've got the go-to gurus with us this hour, ready to share their secrets. This hour on Point in the Kitchen with New York Times food writers Sam Sifton and Melissa Clark. You can join us on air or online. Are you hooked on the cooking newsletter? What have you tried? How did it turn out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here is a video from New York Times food editor Sam Sifton's cooking series. He's putting together a summer squash casserole he says would be a perfect side dish to grilled chicken or a weekend roast.
It is one of the most unpretentious recipes in our archive, down to its use of crumbled Ritz crackers and grated cheddar cheese. We're going to start by melting an enormous amount of butter. 6 tablespoons, onions, pepper, some jalapeno, and some garlic. This is going to be the studded stuff in our casserole.
And here's New York Times food writer Melissa Clark's video cooking series. She's using her electric pressure cooker to prepare barbecue pork with a spicy Korean sauce.
This is exactly what you want to make for a crowd, because you can do most of the heavy lifting a few days ahead. Then right before your guests arrive, slide the whole thing under the broiler, and in 2 minutes, you've got golden brown porky perfection. This is what you're looking for. It should be brown and kind of crunchy looking right where the edges are. And now you can serve this either on a bowl of rice or cute little sliders.
Joining me now from New York City, Sam Sifton, food editor for The New York Times and founding editor of The Times Cooking newsletter. Sam, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you.
And also in New York, Melissa Clark, staff reporter for The New York Times food section, author of 38 cookbooks. Her most recent is Dinner, Changing the Game. You can find recipes from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Melissa, welcome to you.
So great to be here, Jane.
So my mouth is watering. Summer squash casserole and barbecue pork. Porky perfection. We just started. So Sam Sifton, you've created the cooking newsletter, which now has over a million subscribers. It's the most subscribed newsletter at the New York Times, and you get many more million eyeballs on the website itself every month. What was your vision for cooking when you started?
Well, we had an archive of recipes dating back, you know, throughout the history of the New York Times, but digitally back to the early 1980s. And that archive was essentially a dead letter office. These were dead article assets with no pictures, with no joy. They were hard to find. And I thought, and a lot of other people at the New York Times thought, that if we could organize them into a searchable database and then repopulate them with photographs, with stories, with all kinds of functionality, that we might be able to capture the lightning in the bottle that my predecessor, Craig Claiborne, captured when he published in the early 1970s the New York Times Cookbook. The New York Times Cookbook was, of course, a national bestseller for over 10 years at a time when the New York Times was still a regional paper, maybe even just a metropolitan newspaper. Mm. So the opportunity to try and do that in a digital age for a paper with global ambitions seemed like a good bet. And I think it's paying off.
I think so. You've worn a lot of hats at the time, Sam. How did you make your way from national editor to cooking?
Well, I have worn a lot of hats at the Times. The great thing about being a newspaper person is that you can kind of follow your passions in different directions. It's, if you have any form of ADD, it's a terrific job. And so I've been able to work on the culture desk where I ran arts coverage. I ran the national desk, running the national news bureaus. I worked as the restaurant critic. And then when this opportunity to help I hope, help ensure the future of the paper came along, this idea seemed like a great one to jump onto. Mm-hmm. And I must say, after your gracious introduction, it really does seem like a great job.
It does. It is a great job. Melissa, how would you describe your job? It is a great job.
Oh, it's the best job. You know, I mean, not to say that it's not challenging, because it really is, but the challenges are so fun. I mean, I sit around and I get to – well, Sam and I were just talking about Thanksgiving. So, you know, we're in March.
It's early.
So those but well, we have to start thinking about it. So our challenges are, how do we keep people engaged in recipes and food and tell stories in ways that not everybody is doing it, and ways that make them want to get in the kitchen and cook? Mm-hmm. And you know how busy we all are, and we get really overwhelmed. But our job is to put out a recipe, and we want people to go in there, and we don't want them just to cook it. We actually want them to come back, and we want them to comment on it, and we want them to become part of this community that also inspires people to cook.
So, Melissa, you have an MFA in creative writing. How did you start cooking for the New York Times?
You know, I started I started cooking when I was a kid. I grew up in one of those foodie families. You know, you mentioned Julia Child, and my parents were absolute Julia Child disciples. We had Julia Child dinner parties. So that was my framework. And I always knew I wanted to write, but cooking was my metaphor. It was just how I told the story. So when I started writing about food, this was right after I had just gotten out of grad school. I was working in New York, and it was one of those, oh, I know someone who knows someone. And a friend of a friend introduced me to Rick Flast, who was then on staff, and he started, it was the dining in, dining out section, right, Sam?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we need someone to do this little column called The Food Chain. And this was 1998. And people would write in letters. This was actually letter-based. And they'd ask questions about cooking, and I would answer them in the paper. And that's how I started.
So both of you write recipes. It's one of the many things that you do at cooking. Tell me what that process is like, Sam. What goes into developing a recipe?
Well, it's very different work for me and for Melissa. For me, the bulk of the recipes that I develop are adaptations of recipes that I've reported on, work of other people's. I'm not a chef. I'm a pretty good cook, but I'm not a chef. And that I draw that distinction as being that I don't really think the flavors through in my head, and then develop a recipe based on what the muse has told me. What I do is spend time with working cooks, chefs, home cooks alike, and see things that I know to be delicious using my discerning palate, and then figure out how to translate that recipe into something that the home cook can achieve. Mm. And that takes plenty of work, but it's very, very different from what we charge Melissa with, mm-hmm. which is to develop recipes off the dome, as it were, which she does better than almost anyone else in the nation.
Why, wow. Thank you, Sam.
Well, Melissa, you've said that two of the things that are always in the back of your mind when you're cooking or developing a recipe, can I use fewer dishes?
Yes.
And how do I make this better? I appreciate that. I want fewer dishes in my kitchen, too, and I also want good food. What's your process?
You know, it's funny. It usually starts out in the morning. I'm thinking about, what do I want to make for dinner? And I have to think about this earlier than most people, because not only am I going to make dinner, I'm actually going to write about it, and at least once, if not several times. So I'll start out, pretty much just after breakfast, and I'll start thinking about really random things. Like in New York last week, we had some spring weather, and I was thinking peas. Oh, peas are going to be here soon. And then I was thinking, well, pancetta and peas are really good, and they both begin with the letter P. So what if I put them with pork? So pancetta, peas, pork, like a pork chop. And then so I will, send my husband an email saying, what do you think of pork chops with pancetta and peas for dinner? And he's upstairs. He's a writer, and I'm downstairs, but I'll email him anyway, and he'll email me back, that sounds great, knowing full well that when dinner comes, it's going to be Vietnamese salmon because I will go to the store and I will be distracted because salmon will be on sale or something. It's, something always gets in the way. So my creative process is not a straight line, but it is very much, it starts with a craving, and then it meets reality of I go to the store and what is there. And then that pork chop with the peas peas and the pancetta, that'll resurface later on. That's still, you know, that idea is still with me. It just may not come out for a couple of weeks. So it's a little bit of helter-skelter, but it gets me to a good place.
I think that's so fantastic because it's almost the opposite of what I'm doing. The thought process that I'm going through has to do with what did I eat? What is fascinating me about someone else's technique or someone else's marriage of flavors or ingredients, and how can I do that myself? And then I got to work that through it. And it usually involves putting it on a tortilla.
So Sam, don't you love that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, Sam goes on these delightful adventures and you write about them and we'll go through some of them. But I'm curious, how do you decide which chef gets your attention?
It's really about which chef gets my attention, you know what I mean? On the palate. So I can become captivated by a restaurant on the basis of a single dish and then become obsessed with that dish and want to figure out how to make it. So as I said, I spent a number of years as the restaurant critic for the paper, eating out a ridiculous amount and filing away memories of particular dishes, particular techniques, particular flavor combinations that, you know, then come popping back into my head and then got to make a recipe out of them.
When I asked him what was happening in the world today, he said, more butter, more butter, more butter, more. My baby like.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we are dishing this hour with New York Times cooking gurus Sam Sifton and Melissa Clark about jazzing up weekday chicken dinners to the secrets of a successful dinner party. You can join the conversation. What's your showstopper recipe? Are you using more whole grain flours, less sugar, going more international? Here's a video from New York Times food editor Sam Sifton's cooking series. He's demonstrating how to make the perfect hamburger indoors, cooking in rendered fat in a cast iron pan. At this point, he's just flipped the patty.
In order to get the cheese nice and melted, you want to add it the minute you turn that burger over, because you're not going to touch it again until you pull it off. This is one of the big issues with hamburger cooking, is that people want to mess with it. They want to touch. They want to prod. Don't do that. Allow the burger to sit in the pan and allow the fat to do its work within. Don't mess with a hamburger too much and it'll love you back.
And here's Melissa Clark from her series of web videos. In this episode, she's put together a seafood recipe with little prep but big taste.
I love when a meal delivers big flavors for very minimal effort. And this fish with lemon curry butter does just that. This is a kind of recipe that you can make with any kind of mild white fish that you like. In this case, I got flounder, but if you see hake or if you see cod or halibut, you're looking for something mild so that it could really take on the flavor of the curry butter.
We are speaking with Sam Sifton, food editor for The New York Times and creator of The Cooking Newsletter, and Melissa Clark, author and staff reporter for The New York Times food section. Her newest cookbook of 38 is Dinner, Changing the Game. A lot of comments from our listeners, a couple on Twitter. Ted says, all I can say is that my entire 2016 Thanksgiving was according to you, and it was fantastic. Here's another one. I look forward to Easter and Christmas just so I can make Melissa's ham bone soup. Sam, tell us about a dinner party at your house. I mean, the expectations of your guests must be through the roof. Tell us about the menu, and do you feel the pressure?
I don't feel the pressure. I think it's sort of a drag that expectations are high. I'm just a newspaper guy. I do have better access to cooks and chefs, and so I get pretty cool recipes, and I like to try them out. But like Melissa, a lot of the times I'm testing recipes on my guests. And so if there's pressure, it's pressure to know, like, is this actually going to work? And so a couple of weeks ago, working on a baked beans recipe with these excellent heirloom beans that I bought from a farm in Maine over the internet for $2, These things just would not give up the ship. I had soaked them for 18 hours. I was cooking them and cooking them 7 hours in. They were like pebbles on the beach. I didn't know what was going to happen. And they didn't give up the ship. They were really tough all the way through. And only another day's cooking of leftovers, and there were a lot of leftovers, revealed this delicious dish. But boy, that was a dinner party fail, which is why I always serve an enormous amount of alcohol. I want the guests loose.
Now you know.
I want to have the guests loose and have a sort of familial feeling. For years now, my family has tried to gather what we call Sunday dinners. They're not always on Sundays, but they are an opportunity to welcome anyone who happens to be free into the house, where we will serve a large vat of something, a stew, a burgoo, what have you, along with some starch and, as I say, plenty of wine.
Melissa Clark, what are your suggestions for the rest of us when you're cooking for company?
Well, I always say get your guests involved, get them in the kitchen. So that's the number one thing, because especially if you have people over who maybe don't know each other that well or you don't know that well, it's an immediate icebreaker. Except I have done that and then people have cut themselves. But, you know, most of the time it's been – that's the alcohol thing, Sam. But no, it's good to get people engaged in the cooking process and they love it. And I also – you know, we're very casual at our house. Our kitchen is – big and open. So I'm cooking. My guests are cooking along with me. I always have a lot of hors d'oeuvres out so people can, you know, nosh immediately. And yes, you always need to have a lot of alcohol out. But I think the most important thing is gathering your people and try to be in the same room as them, you know, like either cook ahead so you can be in the living room or bring them into the kitchen with you and have them cook with you. Because parties, I mean, yes, the food is incredibly important, but you're there. People are there to see you and you're there to see them. And I think that we get so involved in the meal that we forget that actually we want to spend time with our friends. So make that your number one priority and then serve lots of alcohol and then that's a good party.
So
if your beans are a little hard.
I've got cooks on the line lined up down the street. Let me get a couple in here. Aaron in St. Albans, Vermont. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air with Sam Sipton and Melissa Clark.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Sam and Melissa. I was calling to rave and brag a little bit about the best bean soup that Julia Moskin created. I watched the video the video of her cooking as I was coming back from a trip from Mexico. And as soon as I got off the plane, I wanted to cook this and got in the kitchen, made it last night for dinner. And the first bite, all I could taste was these memories of Mexico, especially the lime pickled red onions. And I definitely felt a little proud of myself because it was totally delicious. And just wanted to say, too, that I love the cooking emails, and it's a highlight of my week. Thanks.
Oh, you're so nice to say. That is an amazing recipe, and you should feel pride in making it well. We feel pride in publishing it. And Julia is another amazing member of our team. And those recipes delight many, many people.
The cooking notes are so helpful, Sam, on the cooking time site at the Times. It's a real community of home cooks, right? They're working it out in the kitchen. And you always offer to help cooks stranded in the middle of a recipe. And I'm curious, do people actually reach out? Do they actually
ask? Oh, my goodness. Yes, they do. We have a care team at cookingcare at nytimes.com that responds to a lot of issues for people in the kitchen. I should stress they don't do it in real time, but we get back as soon as we can. And my inbox is filled all the time with people with issues, mostly to do with how can I change this recipe or where did that recipe come from. And it's really interesting. The notes on the recipes I also find fascinating. Note that they're notes. Language matters in this case. We had a long debate at the birth of NYT Cooking about whether recipes should be amended with notes or with comments. And it was my feeling and our feeling in the end that notes would engender more of a community than comments. Comments lead to, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, you're a jerk. And the notes, which largely comprise ingredient substitutions, issues of oven temperature or altitude or indeed the nation in which the dish is being cooked have proven to be really great for our community, and it is a community.
Let's get Laura in here from Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the program with Sam Sipton and Melissa Clark.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Sam. Hi, Melissa. I'm a longtime New York Times recipe user since I was a kid. And I just wanted to pick up on what Melissa mentioned earlier and what Sam was just saying. I think what makes the New York Times site so amazing is the fact that it's so dynamic. It's a dynamic community. It's crowdsourced, not only from the people that use the recipes and through the notes, but also by the fact that there are many writers and chefs involved in it. And so that makes it different from anything else. And it's this evolving site. And it's amazing. And I just want to say thank you.
Laura, thank you.
Oh, you're so nice to say. That crowdsourcing is at the heart, of course, of what newspapers do. It's the promise that we can deliver on. We have journalists who are relentless in their desire to find out things that are delicious and communicate them to the readers. That we have an audience of readers who are eager to engage in that makes it all the more special.
Thanks for the call, Laura. Melissa Clark, you've authored 38, that's mind-spinning, 38 cookbooks.
She just wrote one.
Yes, I know.
During the break.
The next one, 39. I see. I've got 38 in front of me here, number 38, came out this week. It's about sheep pan dinners. Talk to me about that. Do you have a favorite recipe in there? And what's so special about a sheep pan dinner?
Well, it's you know, sheep pan dinners are a really big part of it, but that's not, you know, the book is called Dinner Changing the Game, and it's about all kinds of dinners. There are sheep pan dinners in there. There are stews. There's an entire chapter on eggs for dinner. There's grain bowls. What I tried to do in that book was take the pressure off you, because when you're coming in after work and you need to cook your dinner, people tend to fall into their ruts. You know, they do the thing that they do with the chicken, or they make their pasta dish that they always make. They don't have time to sit around and think about, well, you know, would roasted grapes taste good with chicken? And that's my job. Mm-hmm. So what I did in this book was create 220 really easy after-work friendly recipes that are different from what you're making now in terms of ingredient combinations, but not hard in terms of technique. Like, you already know how to do that thing with the chicken. Why don't you do that thing with the chicken and add roasted grapes to the pan? You can get grapes, and they're so good when you roast them. They get sweet. They get caramelized. I add just a dash of sherry vinegar, and it just makes it into this really interesting, really simple meal. And that ethos is throughout the entire book.
Well, it's literally hot off the press. They just brought it to me right before we went to air, so I can't wait to dig in here.
Oh, no, I know.
So in the introduction of the book, you encourage readers to engineer your cooking time so that it's one of the most satisfying, quote, satisfying and loveliest moments of your day, which sounds very aspirational to me, because dinner is crunch time for me and a lot of people that I know, you know, getting the kids and the homework and home from work. And how do you make cooking dinner the loveliest moment of your day?
Yeah, you know, okay, so lovely is relative, but just try to make it a little bit better for yourself. You know, you're the one cooking, so organize it so that you have something nice there for you. I mean, even if it's as simple as a glass of wine, I always cook with a glass of wine. I always cook with great music. My husband's job is to pick out some really lovely music. My daughter's job is to keep me company while she's doing her homework in the kitchen, and we're all there. You know, we're doing our thing. You know, my husband's running around, you know, whatever, cleaning up and helping Dahlia do her homework. My daughter's Dahlia. I'm there cooking. We're spending 15 minutes together, and we're trying to just, you know, be in the moment and be with each other while I'm cooking, as opposed to her in one room, my husband in another room, you know, me by myself trying to get everything together. I think if you can bring your family in, and I mean, if that's not possible, then just have your glass of wine by yourself while you're cooking and listen to your music and just have your meditation time. But do something nice for yourself and make the cooking process enjoyable. I mean, if you like to cook, you should like to cook. You should try to like to cook dinner too, not just on the weekends. You know, try to take that pleasure every single day, because it can be a great pleasure.
A lot more calls here. Let's get Sophia in from Beverly, Massachusetts. Sophia, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Sam. I'm Melissa. I have a question about pressure cooking, because I asked for an electric pressure cooker for my birthday, and then I received it, and it's enormous. And and I just said, am I going to use this thing? Where am I going to store it? And does it do anything more than just shorten cooking time? Because if that's all it does, maybe I don't need it.
Sophia, thank you. So, Melissa, you did a whole segment on Instapot, right? Is that what this is?
Yeah, so electric pressure cookers, yeah. Multi-cookers, they're, you know, Instant Pot is one great brand, but there are many others. Yes, you're going to, I think you're going to use it. I think they're great because not only, yes, they do things faster, but they do certain things better, which is why I like them. For example, those beans, Sam, when you were telling your bean story, right. I kept thinking, if you just put them in the pressure cooker, they would cook, and they would cook in, you know, an hour instead of 7 hours, and they'd be delicious. It's great for braising. But what I really love about the electric pressure cooker is that because you're not losing any, you know, there's no evaporation, so you're not losing flavor. All that flavor really is still in the pot. So it cooks things quickly, but it cooks things with a lot of intensity and complexity. So that same stew recipe that you do on the stove or you do in your slow cooker is a little better in your pressure cooker, and it's a lot faster. One thing, though, when people are converting recipes to the pressure cooker, just remember that because there's no evaporation, you don't have a condensation of the sauce. So at the end, just this is I hear this a lot. Cook something in your electric pressure cooker. Take out, you know, if you have meat, take it out and just simmer the sauce for a few seconds so that it condenses, or use a little less liquid to start with. And then you're going to be golden.
And so, you're going to be doing it on a Tuesday night.
Exactly.
This is the interesting thing. It sometimes, yes, it is about speed. But the reason it's about speed for me is that the electric cooker allows you to do things on a weeknight that you would ordinarily do on a weekend. And opening up those possibilities of cooking is super helpful.
Sophia, thanks so much for the call. All right, Sam and Melissa, I have a couple quick questions. Give me a couple quick answers, okay?
You bet.
Most satisfying meal?
Roast chicken, definitely. Roast chicken's it's the most for me. I will gnaw on the bones. I'll eat the wings. I'm so happy with a roast chicken.
Yeah, Sam? You can't beat a roast chicken, but chicken wings at a bar with the game on and a cold beer. That
no game.
Be
wine
good.
At my house. Pizza? Roast chicken. Oh, pizza. Oh, pizza.
Pizza could go. Pizza's
pizza.
Pretty good.
Pizza's good.
All right. Three ingredients you can't live without.
Oh, can I do?
Anchovies, garlic, lemon.
I was going to do that for Melissa. I know that so well. And it's anchovies in a wok. In a wok.
What are yours, Sam?
I think mine are probably jalapenos. Mm-hmm. Lime, and gochujang.
Ooh,
the
nice.
Korean red
yeah,
pepper
I love
paste.
That.
I brush my teeth with it.
One thing you just don't like eating.
Sunchokes.
Really? I like sunchokes.
They make me sick. They have something in them called inulin, and if you are sensitive to it, it gives you gastrointestinal distress.
Ooh, well, let's steer clear of the sunchokes.
All right, Sam, worst thing you've ever made.
I had a really big brain once, like not a little calf's brain cut like it's scrambled eggs, but like a big meaty brain. That was pretty bad. Although those beans from the other night came pretty close until I finally dialed in on them.
We're talking about the joys of home cooking with Sam Sifton and Melissa Clark. Sam is food editor of the New York Times. He's the founding editor of the Cooking Newsletter, the most subscribed to newsletter at the Times. Melissa Clark, staff reporter for the Times food section. She's also author of the new book, Dinner, Changing the Game. Listeners, we'd love to have you join us. Do you plan meals ahead or open up the fridge and pull meals together? Have you tried those recipe kits? Does that still feel like cooking? Much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sacrebleu! What is this? How on earth could I miss such a sweet little succulent plant? Quel dommage! What a loss! Here we go, in the sauce! Now some flour, I think. Now I'll stuff you with bread! Don't hurt, because you're dead, and you're certainly lucky you are. Cause it's gonna be a hot in magic silver pot. Tout de nuit, mon poisson, au revoir!
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're opening the recipe box this hour to see what's cooking with the New York Times foodies Melissa Clark and Sam Sifton. You can join the conversation, listeners. What are your questions for Melissa and Sam? Don't be shy. Here's an episode of the Food Network's Chopped. Four previous runners-up are competing for redemption, hoping to win the $10,000 prize. Here, host Ted Allen is challenging the cooks to use an unorthodox combination of ingredients to create three dishes, an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert.
Chefs, please open your baskets. And for the appetizer course, the mandatory ingredients are sweetbreads, dried dates, red Malabar spinach, and strawberry popsicles. You have 20 minutes on the clock for this round, starting now.
And in this episode of the Food Network's Worst Cooks in America, host and chef Bobby Flay tells the contestants they have to cut and prepare the fresh fish they just caught.
So for today's Skill Jewel Challenge, we're going to teach you guys how to cut things like fruits, vegetables, and you'll also be learning how to fillet that fresh fish there.
Fillet a fish as a sandwich.
Here we have this whole black sea bass. We're going to take our kitchen shears now, and we're going to take the fins off.
I can't even cut an onion. Now I have to fillet a fish? I mean, really?
Sam Sifton, what do you make of all these cooking shows on TV and cable? You know, the Chopped and Great British Bake Off and 30-Minute Meals, all these celebrity chefs. What do you make of it all?
We've moved in our consumption of television food from instruction, dump and stir stuff, to competition. Can you take a candy bar and a dried date and make something out of it? And I'm not sure that that does a great thing for us as home cooks. Stunt cooking doesn't seem to me to be at the heart of what we need as a nation at this moment. But of course, it's wildly entertaining. And maybe some skills are going to be imparted along the way. I would count among them filleting your own fish. Yes, it's easy to go for the fillet of fish. That's a sandwich joke. But at the end of the day, if we are, whether as entertainers, as Mr. Flay sometimes is, or as home cooks, as Melissa and I comport to be in mm-hmm. the newspaper, mm-hmm. if we are teaching people how to do things that make it easier for them to cook, then we're doing a good job. I take a measured approach, a look at the TV guys.
I want to get Nashville in here. Haley is there. You're on the air. Haley, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I just wanted to share, I was raised in the South, and I was kind of trained as a home cook in my grandma's kitchen where she fried everything, and everything had butter and cheese in it. And cooking was never that fun for me. But recently, this past year or so, my husband and I and our 15-month-old daughter have gone vegan. And that's really changed, obviously, my cooking style and the entire way that I approach cooking. You know, it's a lot more fun now. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a challenge to it. And ingredient substitution and using, fresh herbs and fresh produce. And it's been a lot more fun.
Haley, thank you. A couple of questions on our website, Sam and Melissa. What's your idea for all the various food restrictions that people have these days? Vegetarian, no dairy, vegan, all that. What do you say?
Well, we deal with this every single day at Cooking because some number of our audience carry a restricted diet of some sort. So it's incumbent on us to make sure that we have recipes that are cookable by everyone. That doesn't mean that we're seeking an average of some sort where everything is tasty to everyone. But we're as mindful that we do need to have some great vegan food in there as we do to have a great fried chicken recipe. And working to keep that balance up is important to us and kind of fun to report on.
Sean is in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jane. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
You bet. Go ahead.
Hey, I was listening to the caller earlier talk about, pressure cookers and making cooking the faster process, especially on weekdays. And I just wanted to comment because my wife and I were both full-time students and, we go to school all day and we got to do homework all night. And so for, I think a lot of people in our position, cooking is just, kind of a pain. But what we found is a way to make it, not only something we do every night, but something that's fun. And what she'll do is, or what we'll do is we'll spend about an hour on a Sunday, kind of looking through cookbooks, picking out recipes, and we'll plan everything down in the last ingredient. What that does is when we go to the store, we know what we're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're cooking on weeknights, what that allows us to do is just pull things out of the fridge as we need them.
More efficient.
And we know what we're we know what we're cooking and we know what we're making. And it just kind of eliminates a lot of, I think, dead time.
Good for you, Sean. I appreciate your call. It's a great idea. Have fun, you guys, out there in Omaha. Pamela is in Nashville. You're on the air. Welcome. Pamela, hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about my, I was listening to the program, and I wanted to tell you about my 9-year-old granddaughter.
Okay.
We were riding along one day, and just out of the blue, she said she thought she would go to culinary school. And I said, culinary school? I said, well, she loves to bake and cook. And I said, well, after you get your college degree, then you can do anything you want. You can go to culinary school, have your own business if you want. But, her name is Catherine Claire,
mm-hmm.
and she makes everything that she bakes without a recipe.
At nine. At nine, yeah.
Yes, at nine. She'll be 10 in August.
Huh.
But she has learned this from her mother, who is a fabulous cook and a fabulous baker.
Uh-huh.
From me, I do not as good as my daughter.
Yeah.
But I can cook. We're, from the South, so we can all cook. And then I have a sister who is a fabulous cook.
So it runs in the family. I think your granddaughter may be the next Melissa Clark. We'll see. I want to play this clip of Melissa with her then 4-year-old daughter, Dahlia, making a buttercream frosting for a birthday cake.
Okay, now you want to try it with all the stuff in it and tell me if you like it better.
I love it.
Okay, cool. Should we frost the cake? So this one is an almond cake, which is one of my favorites. It's almost like a pound cake, but a little bit lighter. Hey, Dahlia, how old do you think I'm turning on my birthday?
15.
15? Yeah, you're close.
14.
14? Yeah, maybe just a little older. Not much, though. Ta-da!
Beautiful!
Right? Beautiful!
Very nice. So Melissa and Sam, you heard Pam there with her 9-year-old granddaughter who cooks without ingredients, without recipes. Do you follow recipes?
The first time I bake, I always do. I'm very impressed with that 9-year-old who can cook, who can bake without, because baking is much more of a science. When I'm cooking, I don't follow recipes because I'm creating them. I'm just cooking. But for the baking, that's much more exacting. And I always follow a baking recipe the first time through, and then I'll change it. And then I'll, it's actually much harder to develop a baking recipe than it is to develop a savory recipe because it's so scientific. You can cut the sugar, sure. You can change up the nuts and add chocolate chips or whatever. But in terms of the structure, that really takes a lot of finessing.
We're speaking with Sam Sifton and Melissa Clark from the New York Times cooking section. Sam, we mentioned your delightful adventures cooking with chefs across the country and around the world. I loved your piece, many of them, but I love the one on Yotam Ottolenghi. The headline was, "A British by way of Jerusalem chef who assembles a Middle Eastern banquet in London that is as visually stunning as it is delicious."
Which is a really long headline when you think about it.
But tell us about one of your favorite encounters.
Well, I was down in Texas not too long ago cooking with a chef named Quayle Watson from a restaurant called Hot Joy in San Antonio. And we were going to do one of these feasts, you know, where we gather together a bunch of people, friends of his, people from the community and the like, mm-hmm. cook all day and then serve them. And Hot Joy is a kind of Tex-Mex by way of Asia restaurant. And so he was going to cook that sort of food. He wanted to make cabrito, barbecued goat, but he wanted to do it with the flavors of Southeast Asia. We made queso also with the flavors of Southeast Asia. Put together this kind of magical concoction of flavors that really spoke to patterns of migration that had seen Vietnamese come in to the community mm-hmm. over the years, and then, as always, piled onto warm tortillas.
Let's get Sally in here from Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hi, Sally. You're on the air with Sam Sifton and Melissa Clark from the New York Times.
Hi. I was calling because I have a large family, and on more than one occasion, we've been pretty broke. And so I have made a personal goal to be able to create delicious recipes for, you know, less than a dollar per person. Mm.
How do you do it, Sally? What's your trick? What's your secret?
Well, Hop and John is split pea soup. And also, whenever I use meat, I will shred it so that it lasts longer. Mm.
Oh, I think that's a great move. Excellent. And I think that paying attention to food cost is one of the more exciting challenges for a good cook. And what you discover, as I think you probably have discovered, is that if you reduce that portion of meat per person, you're reducing food cost, yes, but you're not losing that much flavor along the way. And if you can create a melange of flavors in a big pot and serve it with some rice and some beans, you'll be serving people delicious food for a lot less money than you would ordinarily.
And it's environmentally, it's better too, you know, to eat less meat in general.
Let's go to Tom in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say my wife and I, we live right next to a university with about 20,000 students, and there's a lot of international students. We started having parties at the house, giving them American food, and then we started having some of the students cook foods from their country. And it's just so much fun. We've learned a lot about cooking, and it's also a great way for the students to kind of bring their culture to here and share with not only us. We've had parties. We've had students from like every continent, but Australia and Antarctica at the same party.
That's wonderful.
Just food is a great way, a great medium to make friends.
Wonderful, Tom. Thank you, Melissa. You've been taking a deep dive into classic French food, right? This new Essentials of French Cooking on the site.
Yes.
What should we know about French cooking?
You know, so we did this. New Essentials of French Cooking. We call it the French Food Guide, and it's online at NYT Cooking. And you can find 20 recipes that are classically French. But what we did is we used each recipe as a way to tell the story of French cuisine. So it's not just a recipe, but there's history in there. There's context in there. And there's also a lot of guide to technique. Because we're very interested right now in international cooking, which is great culturally for the United States. We should be learning about other cultures as much as possible. But we do tend to forget that French food is a building block. The techniques of French food have been building blocks of cuisines throughout the world. And what the French did was in the 18th century, they codified their cuisine. They wrote down everything and they used it to teach chefs and to teach cooks how to cook. And that, the learning process and how to really understand the technique will help you be a better cook no matter what kind of cuisine you're cooking. And that's what we did at the New Essentials of French Cooking is we use French cuisine as a lens to really improve your cooking skills, to learn about the history of a cuisine, and then you take that in any direction you want. And your technique will be forever improved.
Let's get Debbie in here from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. I'm going to make my question pretty quick so you can answer it for me. My son joined one of those recipe clubs where they send him food. He's in college, so I was shocked, and I thought that was kind of pricey. So I'm just wondering, you know, is that a good move for a young person? Is it nutritionally good? And I'm wondering, hey, maybe he'll learn how to cook. You know, is that part of the benefit?
All right, Debbie, thank you.
I think it probably is part of the benefit. It's like a little starter packet that teaches you how to cook. One of the lines of reporting that we've done on these meal kit services is to see, do people stick with the service, or do they use the service as kind of training wheels for learning to ride a bike or learning to cook it at home? I rather suspect that is how people are going to use them ultimately, that once you've put yourself into the modality of cooking every day, mm-hmm. Eventually you can wean yourself off the big packages and all the packaging that's surrounding it and start, yeah, I think I can dice the onion. I don't need the onion diced for me. Mm-hmm. Or I'd like to cook something else, something from the New York Times, say, and then go about doing it.
Melissa, are you a gadget cook, or, you know, are you just all I need is a paring knife and a cutting board?
There are a couple of inexpensive gadgets that make my life so much easier, and I try to encourage home cooks to get them. So for the most part, yes, you will do fine with a nice, you know, knife and a cutting board. You're good to go. But what's made my life easier, I love a fine grater, like a Microplane or any other brand. A fine grater is amazing because it will reduce your garlic cloves to paste in 2 seconds. It will grate your ginger for you. It will take your zest off your lemons. And for me, I'm using those ingredients pretty much every day. And they're easy to clean. You throw them in the dishwasher, and they're cheap. So I really think that if, you know, people who are using a garlic press right now, nope, trade it in. Get your Microplane. You'll get a better garlic. You'll get a puree. Sheet pan. We were talking about sheet pans. Yeah. I love a sheet pan. If you have a sheet pan, get another one. If you don't have one, get one. If you have one, get two. Yeah. And if you have two, get three. Sheet pans are, you know, they're like jelly roll pans. They're big baking pans with low sides so you can make things crispy in the oven and nice and brown. And they're cheap.
Sam Sipton, I give you the last word here. What should every home cook know?
That if you get a digital oven-safe thermometer, you will never overcook a chicken again. You'll never overcook a roast again. You'll have much better Thanksgiving outcomes. Please do it and visit us at mitcooking.com.
What a great hour, Sam Sifton, food editor at the New York Times. Thanks so much for your work and for being here today.
Thank you.
Melissa Clark, the new cookbook is Dinner, Changing the Game. You can find recipes from her book at our website, onpointradio.org. Melissa Clark, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.